Hi, everyone, and welcome to Remaking Tomorrow, a series of conversations about the future of teaching and learning. I'm Ryan Rudzeski, here with Greg Baer, and we're the co-authors of When You Wonder, You're Learning, Mr. Rogers' Enduring Lessons for Raising Creative, Curious, Caring Kids.
This is a podcast powered by Remake Learning, a network that ignites engaging, relevant, and equitable learning in support of young people navigating rapid social and technological change.
On today's episode, we're talking with Michael Preston, Executive Director of the Joan Ganz Cooney Center at Sesame Workshop. An independent research and innovation lab within Sesame Workshop, the Cooney Center researches emerging technologies and works with producers and educators and a whole lot of others to use that research in support of children's learning and well-being in the digital age. Michael brings more than two decades of experience in innovation and educational technology to his role as the center's director. We're so excited to talk to you, Michael Preston. Welcome to Remaking Tomorrow.
Thank you, Ryan. Thank you, Greg. There's no podcast on which I would most like to appear.
Fortunately, there are no other podcasts in the world, so you've come to the one and only podcast.
Podcasting seems really interesting and cool. I'm eager to learn more about what are podcasts.
So lots of listeners of this podcast will surely be familiar with the sunny days sweeping the clouds away on Sesame Street. But first, can you just tell us a little bit about Sesame Workshop? What is it, and how did you, Michael Preston, get there?
It's funny, Sesame Street and the workshop, as a person who spends most of my time thinking about it, it's funny to think back about who doesn't yet know what we are. We're a 55-year-old nonprofit organization founded in New York City. We produce a television program that first aired in the US, but now airs globally. I think we're in 150 countries. And we reach millions and millions of kids around the globe. Sesame was started, for those who don't know the backstory, by Joan Ganz Cooney and her co-founder Lloyd Morissette, who in the middle of the 1960s mused that televisions were in most homes, including in New York City apartments and townhouses and everywhere. And that at the same time, lots and lots of kids were showing up for school not prepared for academics. Many kids didn't know their letters and numbers. This was before kindergarten was widespread, never mind, you know, what we think about today as like a universal pre-K system or even 3K. And so at that time, there was this enormous potential to fill a gap where before the age of five or six, kids could really benefit from something from this new medium that was in households, but not yet really used educationally for kids. The lore is that they were watching Julia Child. Her first episodes aired on GBH in 1965. And so over the context of a dinner inspired by one of her episodes, they mused that kids were already learning commercial jingles and game show theme songs and that sort of thing. And what else could they learn? And then the rest is kind of history. And it kicked off at a research project by Joan, who spoke to experts around the country and community leaders and sought opportunities for this kind of thing and published a blueprint in 66. It saw its first episode on the airwaves in November of 1969. I think Jennifer Carolyn from Reach Capital characterized Sesame as the first ed tech innovation in a way. It's using the medium of the day to achieve some kind of learning at scale for kids everywhere. And beyond that, the Sesame's had this long history of creating innovative content that leveraged both high engagement techniques for getting kids excited about content and wanting to watch and stay tuned in, really novel techniques for creating storylines and music and art and making it really captivating for kids, but also ensuring that it had the educational impact that was intended. It was also born out of a whole operational approach that was new that we replicate to this day, 55 years later, every single year. So it was groundbreaking in every sense. Obviously, it also, there's a lot of attention paid to the multiracial cast, the first on television, at least for kids, as far as I know. Obviously, the presence of Muppets made an enormous difference and to set a bar for what it means to entertain and teach at the same time.
Michael, I love being reminded of that remarkable Sesame history. It's so inspiring to hear it, as you say, nearly six decades later. And at Sesame, you lead the Joan Ganz Cooney Center, named, of course, after that giant of children's media whom you just mentioned, someone who's right up there with Fred Rogers, among other people who had an incredible impact on the field. How does the center you lead take inspiration from Joan still today?
That's a great question. And frankly, one that I get to think about every day. It's quite a privilege. I mean, the same way that your world and the Remake Learning Universe get to think about Fred Rogers' impact on not only his own work, but all of us and the work that we carry forward. With Joan really looms large within the workshop and certainly in our center, which is named for her. We were founded in 2007, and I think it's a really easy story. We continue to ask her original question, how do we leverage today's emerging media to benefit kids? It's as simple as that. And as luck would have it, today's emerging media is constantly changing. In the 16, 17 years we've been in existence, if you think about all the things that have happened, you know, the year we launched, the iPhone came out and the iPad was a few years on its heels, and that really changed kids' experience with technology as a touchscreen and a personal device, you know, and the proliferation of everything that followed. But nowadays, kids listening to podcasts, kids interacting with screen media of all kinds, kids now engaging AI agents, whether they know it or not, in all kinds of things they use. So we get to push in, inspired by the kind of original premise of Sesame, think about how we can reach and teach through whatever medium is most prevalent or captivating or has a lot of leverage for something that we haven't quite figured out yet. I think those are the most interesting spaces for us right now.
That singular question that Joan first asked, guiding everything you do, how do we leverage today's emerging media to benefit kids? And it seems like your center is asking and answering that question in all sorts of really exciting ways. I just want to start with one of them, the Cooney Center Sandbox, and its work to bring in children, actually to co-design media, to act as co-designing media consultants. Can you tell us a little bit more about the Sandbox? What is it, and what have you learned from your time in it?
The codename for the project was Sesame as a Service. Like, what could we do to deliver Sesame ideas to everybody else? And the Sandbox for me, as a kid who grew up watching Sesame Street, there's an episode in the first season where Bert and Ernie are having a chat, and Ernie wants to play a little game with Bert. He says, I'll go first. I won the Sandbox. You say I do the Sandbox. And so they end up, obviously, I seven the Sandbox, and then he forces Bert to say, I ate the Sandbox. I ate the Sandbox. How did it taste? Anyway, so I always was sort of inspired by that idea of the Sandbox. Sandbox in technology obviously tends to mean more of like a place where you can experiment and try out new things in the safety of a server or some kind of online space that other people aren't seeing it yet. It's you can mess around and things might not work. For us, it was a safe space and a playful and creative space where we could center kids in design. And I think that has a couple of purposes. One is to really get designers of tech and media for kids excited about the prospect of doing something creative. I think we're all kind of innately creative. You two are the last people I need to tell this to. But tapping into adults' desire to play and be creative is an easy lift. And learn how to do it side by side with kids who, rather than just conceiving of kids as an audience for what they're making, but to conceive of them as their partners in what they're making, and to have the opportunity to create a space where kids and adults can happily do something together, which doesn't happen often enough in this world, and then arrive at a new place together that would not otherwise happen is the premise. We all know that kids can be used as, you know, informants and consultants in the design of something new. At the very least, you're testing a product that's mostly done, where you're just making sure it works and kind of has the effect you want. But I think none of that is assured, and that there's so much power and there's so much leverage early on in the process when ideation is happening, where kids can come up with these great insights. True to everything we do, we build on other people's work and the shoulders of giants like Allison Druin, for example, whose work at University of Maryland in the 90s on co-design with kids was basically a shorthand for cooperative inquiry experiences in the design of technology with kids. And the idea of having kids regularly attend an after-school program where they would then be inducted into the ways of design and then partnering with adults was kind of a newfangled thing. It's called Kids Team. So we borrow heavily from their work and have partnered with them and are building resources with the Kids Team Network today. But the idea is to really elevate this idea of kids as partners, to think about participatory design as something that benefits everybody. Kids learn something, develop a sense of efficacy, self-efficacy, see how things get made, get treated seriously by adults. The adults get insights they wouldn't get otherwise. They have a lot of fun and realize that they're missing something significant if they leave kids out of the process. And then the argument that we're making to business owners and the decision makers, as it were, the management, that is that if they do something early like this, they have much more potential to make something magical. They also have the opportunity to engage diverse audiences early on and understand if it's going to reach and have the impact that they intend. And so there's just lots of benefits, and we're trying to make people feel like this is something they must do.
Thinking about that sandbox and participatory design, let's think about someone who's not involved in children's media and knows nothing about it. Someone, I don't know, someone like Ryan, who is... So what is it that caring adults, parents, educators, what might they learn from this approach? Because clearly what you're describing could easily and should easily extend far beyond the children's media landscape.
Yeah, it's a great premise. I think all of us have ideas about the way things should be. And a part of maturing and becoming a more developed person or even an adult is the perspective-taking journey and valuing other ideas and opinions and realizing that your own ideas will be made better by others' input. And there's a certain magical alchemy to partnering with other people and benefiting from their different ideas. And so I think that that's just a value, and applying it to design. You can be a well-read person, you can have kids in your life, but to actually get feedback directly on an idea from kids in the moment when faced with kind of a task or challenge, it's just kind of an opportunity to destabilize, I think, assumptions about what kids like, what they want, and just hear it directly from them. And these kids came in with a strong sense of like what deserved negative feedback or pushback. Your kids really are interested in right and wrong, for example, to generalize a bit, and not only to name kinds of behaviors that they felt were worthy of either celebration because they were positive or some kind of pushback or, you know, identification as negative, and how to do it. There's a lot of detail. You know, designers have to make tons and tons of decisions all day long. They do it potentially based on assumptions and, you know, broad strokes ideas as in their creative mode. And to actually hear the kids say, no, that's not how it works for us, you know. I think especially now as kids get inducted into digital life much sooner and in much, much more robust ways than we were as old people.
This is Greg Baer. I'm here with my co-host Ryan Rudzeski, and we're talking with Michael Preston, Executive Director of the Joan Ganz Cooney Center at Sesame Workshop. Michael, turning to those designers and those producers of children's technology and multimedia with whom you work so closely, you've elevated ideas of well-being through some fellowship programs at the center. Can you tell us about some of the work that they're doing, and how do you see well-being work evolving in a media landscape?
The well-being movement has been such a welcome arrival on the scene for lots of reasons. In our world, we tend to focus on industry, given the positionality of the Cooney Center, but we think about how to bring kids' ideas to industry, to designers and developers. And at the same time, there's also this much larger public conversation about kids' wellness in digital spaces that has been overdue and made more salient, more acute even in the last few years, based on, you know, the pandemic and post-pandemic phenomena and a kind of a cultural sense that we're all kind of not feeling great. And the attribution, for better or for worse, that digital experiences are detrimental to well-being in many cases, whether sometimes borne out by evidence and sometimes not. There's been an interesting opportunity then to elevate kids' ideas of well-being and their voices and how they define their own wellness and well-being in ways that are attractive to think about as frameworks for design. And so, for example, we started partnering a few years ago with an initiative called RITECH, the Responsible Innovation and Technology for Children Initiative, which was originated by the LEGO Group and UNICEF and supported by the LEGO Foundation. And we were lucky enough to tag along as kind of a US partner, but also as a proponent of this work to our audiences. And it was started as a global research study of kids all over the world and how they defined digital play experiences of effects on their well-being and what ideas they elevated. And so it ended up becoming a framework that included things that I think everyone could recognize as components of their own well-being, but these were from the voices of kids. So things like autonomy, their ability to freely choose how they play and how they interact, competence, growing their own ability and effectiveness and skills, emotions, ability to feel lots of different emotions, relationships to feel connected, creativity, to use their imagination, developing their identities, and so forth. And so these all came out of this sort of global research enterprise, and it was derived directly from what kids had to say. And for us, that was a truly inspiring place from which to begin. And so our work through the fellowship, like you mentioned, and some other work we're engaged in, has been to try to help folks who are interested in this work put it into their own design efforts and to share their work. And so we took on a cohort last year of 10 brave souls who were willing to start with us. The folks from Pinterest very generously supported the work. And we were off and running and ran basically an online class for 4 months with lots of guest speakers and lots of reading material. And we learned together. We ended up with 10 fellows with 10 very different projects. And the benefit was we all discovered something together, but also there's some more examples in the world now of how people can put these kinds of ideas into practice. It's not just sort of a thing that's sort of nice to think about, but not necessarily concrete. As a value, we want the field to see this as a learning opportunity. You can start no matter where you're coming from, and there's a support network and there are tools for you out there, and you just have to bravely go forward and try it.
Michael, you are coming to this work from a place of deep experience. You have your role at the Cooney Center and your colleagues there. You now have this cohort of well-being fellows. Elsewhere, you've co-founded CS for All, which works to elevate computer science to its rightful place, we think, in K-12 learning. If you had to synthesize all this, you're talking to a parent or an educator who feels that technological innovation is dizzying and fast-paced and overwhelming, all of which is probably true. What advice do you have for that parent or that teacher, these folks who are already balancing so much, if they want to ask you, how do I stay informed? How do I stay ready? How do I best support my young people when it comes to navigating these emerging technologies?
I think for me, the through line for my whole career actually in education and learning and technology and kids and all the rest has been starting with the purpose, thinking about what kind of experience or outcome you most want to have for the young person, and then drive from there. And the most successful things I've been involved with have always focused on some tangible outcome for the young person, whether it's giving them agency or the ability to see technology as a creative tool rather than more of a passive tool to just kind of digest content, which I know is how we mostly use a lot of technology these days. But as technology has gotten easier and more accessible and faster and more powerful, there's, I think, always a risk that it can take agency away from you and just kind of direct your experience. And so for me, the CS for All community was an attempt to demystify computing and help kids understand how computers think and work so that they can more effectively make them do their bidding in ways that are creative and drawn from as an extension of their own interests and passions. And similarly, I think all of the participatory design work we do, or the centering of kids and the sort of evidence-based around kids in design is another version of that. For families or educators who are thinking about this stuff, I think it goes back to like, what do you want for your kids? What do you want them to be able to do? And then drive from there. There's stuff out there. It's more of a smart consumer question of like, what are the tools that both best meet the needs of my kids?
Great. Michael, we are running out of time, but before we go, we want to play a little Michael Preston trivia. Are you game for that?
Yes, I hope I do okay.
All right, we're just going to ask you a couple of rapid-fire questions about you and your life, some of which are related to your work, some of which aren't, but I think your answers, you know, I hope they're good too. All right, you ready?
Okay.
So your father worked at Bell Labs. You have been working in computer science and educational technology. I would have guessed, having heard you, that you majored in computer science as an undergraduate, but you didn't. You majored in East Asian studies. What brought you to that field of study?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, I changed majors like several times in college. I really just was kind of a little bit not lost, but really wanted to try everything when I got to college, especially what I hadn't already tried in high school. And I found myself in Japanese language class as a freshman because I wanted to break out of what I already knew, and found this warm and welcoming department at the university of faculty, graduate students, and undergrads who all communed together. And it just felt really awesome. And also, I could go abroad and study and work. I had a summer internship in an agricultural machinery company, which is a story I can tell you another time, and went to college there for 1 year. And so it just kind of took me in a fun direction, and I didn't know where it was going to take me. And it was just a great experience.
Well, in true polymath style, it took you to a PhD eventually in cognitive science and education. What is the most surprising thing you learned about the science of learning?
I don't know if I have a facile answer for that. I do think motivation is so interesting, though. And it's obviously so core to human experience. And so I've just always been fascinated by the effect sort of emotions and interests on what people learn and how.
Is there a Sesame Street neighbor, puppet or otherwise, that has a special place in your heart?
Too hard to pick. I guess as a Gen X kid, I am a natural Grover guy. You know, I actually remember seeing him on TV with Stevie Wonder. I remember seeing that in the morning and then waiting all day so I could see it when it replayed again at the end of the day.
And Michael, before we go, just one more question. What's one thing that parents and educators can do today to make tomorrow a more promising place for every learner?
I think whatever you can do as a shared experience is the best one. And I think technology can be fun for that. I know it's sort of the Sesame mantra that, you know, from co-viewing a television show to sort of a joint media experience, like some of the hardest things right now about tech is our individual experiences that don't bring us together. The more we use media to bring ourselves together, the better.
Well, we are grateful for this shared experience with Michael Preston, Executive Director of the Joan Ganz Cooney Center at Sesame Workshop. Remaking Tomorrow is powered by Remake Learning. Learn more at remakelearning.org.